Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. We're glad that you came today for our two featured writers, Sam Ligon and Robert Lopez. Before they are introduced, we have a few reminders for you.
Please don't smoke. Please turn your cell phones off. And if possible, refrain from getting up and moving around during the reading. We'll take a 10-minute break between the two readers. Also, coming up next to introduce our first reader, Sam Ligon, is Danilo Thomas.
Hey. So what you have to know about Eastern Washington is that it's a place and also a college. But also that in the time of snow and bears, it was flattened by torrents. Unleashed when crumbling and tremendous dams of ice bursts, the waters covering North America from Montana all the way to Minnesota, scoured the hill and rock of Eastern Washington, laying bare the earth's crusts where only hard things can grow out of the hard scrabble to continue slantingly in their evolution. They grew terrible and fierce while the last members of humanity to walk from Asia to North America limped across the Beringian ice bridge. The hunt and battle with tusk and tooth and fang and talon and spear left carcasses of beast and man strewn on the ground to be picked by the scavengers, to enter the ground and repopulate the earth with bright bone. Even now, there's a field of blood where the eagles land to fight, and burgers dub Big Buster, the Boss, and the Big Zipper come triple stacked on a hoagie roll and slathered in cheese and pig. It is horrible to behold, and it is no surprise to me that tales such as those told by the man Sam Ligon come from the Northland, heaped as those bones come heaped, removed from the live and feeling bodies, artfully gathered into the stuff of legend. For Sam's stories, legends they are. Legends of goats and teens and how nothing is better than being touched by someone you might love. Legends of kings and pies soaked in rye. Legends of beaked off noses and anger and hate and death and comeuppance. Legends of the legends that we tell ourselves that provide small solace in a crazy, false, and unforgiving world in order to prolong our merriment, foot on the accelerator, soaked at the bottom of a big friendly. They're legends of things that get bad and then get worse and then get worse. Legends of grotesques and love, the world around them disfigured by their radiance. With the refreshing tinge of humor, Sam Ligon writes of hardship and discovery, of the exchange that occurs with that discovery, how we replace old selves with new and uncanny knowledge, how we forge on in the face of all of it, and for better or worse, kick dust on our origins with every step we take into the future. Sam Ligon is the author of two novels, Among the Dead and Dreaming and Safe in Heaven Dead. He is also the author of two collections of stories, Wonderland, which is illustrated by Stephen Nezevich, if I said that correctly, and Drift and Swerve, which is excellent. He edits the excellent journal Willow Springs, teaches at the Eastern Washington and Eastern Washington University in Spokane, by which he actually means Cheney, and is the artist, and is the artistic director of the Port Townsend Writers Conference. So without further ado, Sam Ligon.
Hey, you all. Thanks for coming out. You can go ahead and smoke. It's fine. So I have two books came out in April that I wrote. One is a novel called Among the Dead and Dreaming, and one is this book of stories called Wonderland. And Rob and I have been going around reading a lot of places. And tonight I'm just going to read from Wonderland. The novel is a novel about people, and it's for sale, and it's excellent. You should read it. It's fantastic. But I'm not reading from that book. I'm reading from this book. So Wonderland is, it's 13 short stories. They're illustrated. It's a picture book. You can't see the pictures, but I'm going to hold it up anyway, because it's fun to hold up a book when you're reading from it. So you should look at the pictures. There are what holds these stories together. They're mostly love stories. They're concerned with love. They're absurd for the most part. They're very short. Some of them are just very short, kind of weird stories. Some of them are artifacts like blurbs or prayers. Some of them are kind of based on fairy tales or nursery rhymes. So I'm going to read a little bit of each of those kinds of stories. I'm going to read three short shorts. Be under 20 minutes. So the first one I'm going to read is the title story called Wonderland. This is the picture. I know you can't see it. I met Sheena at Wonderland, a traveling carnival that took me in when I ran from home. We'd pull into town and I'd set up the sideshow booths, haul swag and stock vendors, and when the run was over, I'd break it all down. I was 16 years old, as strong as any man there. Sheena was the bearded lady, the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. I didn't know how much there was to want in the world until I saw her, and then I wanted it all. My father broke 7 bones in me before I was 15. He didn't have any goodness in him except when he sang Hank Williams or George Jones, mournful songs of lost love and heartache. He sang like an angel, and when he was done singing, he'd cry for my mother, and when he was done crying, he'd come after me. I felt all his sorrow and loss the night I left home. He took an axe handle to my back, and while I'd be badly bruised, I was able to pull myself from the floor and run. Hours later, I saw Sheena on her trailer steps at Wonderland, and something broke in me for good, some brittle thing I didn't know was there, and then it just kept breaking. I didn't know a woman could have such glowing skin, such carriage. I didn't know a woman could look like that. Her beard wasn't heavy or long like Stonewall Jackson's, but delicate, wispy, crow purple black. On her sideshow board, she was a hairy demon, eyes popping from her head, but in the flesh, she was powerful and fragile, her hair cut in a perfect Prince Valiant. Every time I saw her, I felt born again. The country hit that summer was You're Not Woman Enough to Be My Man, lonesome Kitty Valor's voice pouring over the hot metal and cotton candy of Wonderland. I'd see Sheena and my lungs would collapse. I hadn't been on the road 2 weeks and already I was a freak. I was glad I hadn't killed my father and sorry I'd waited so long to run, wondering how much of myself I'd lost to him. I'd sit outside Sheena's trailer at night, listening to Kitty Valor's song about men and women and men, and I'd wonder if any of us had a chance in this world. Sometimes a man would wait for Sheena out back of the sideshow. Sometimes she'd bring him home. I'd been moving my sleeping bag closer to her door, and when the rain came slashing out of the mountains, she told me to bed down on the dry ground under her trailer. I'd let you sleep inside, she said, but I'm having company. I knew about her company. I knew what men paid her for, and I heard them above me that night, the animal noises they made, hollowing me. The rain was so heavy, I didn't dare come out. Later, when she said it was time for him to leave, and he said, I don't think so, I crawled into the rain, listening hard. No, she said, stop it. I opened the door and she was thrashing, one of his big paws over her mouth. She bit him and he slapped her, even as he pulled her tighter against him. Put her down, I said, and he said, or what? Sheena twisted and he twisted with her. I punched him in the kidneys the way my father punched me. I punched him until he let Sheena go. He ran out the door looking back with fear in his eyes, which satisfied me and made me sick. The punches I'd thrown crackled in my hands and shoulders. I'd probably never be woman enough for Sheena now. But when I turned, she was setting a long-barreled revolver on her kitchen counter. Thanks, she said. I appreciate your concern. I guess you had it covered, I said, nodding toward her cowboy gun. She was wearing this black, silky thing, a slip maybe. My eyes were pulled all over her. I concentrated on her beard. It's still raining, she said. Why don't you sleep on the floor here? All right, I said, and I lay on her floor breathing her molecules while she slept on the other side of an accordion door. The next night, she was drinking beer out front of her place. You want one, she said, looking me up and down. Sure, I said. One beer won't hurt anything, she said. We drank one beer at her dinette, and then we drank a bottle of whiskey, every cell in my body vibrating with her. She put on some hillbilly music, and we danced, rubbing against each other. I couldn't breathe the air around her. We sat at her dinette, and she told me about her first whisker, about shaving and worrying until she realized her beard was her fortune. Do you want to touch it? She said. Of course I wanted to touch it. It was soft as could be, her skin around it softer still. It wasn't the first thing I noticed about you, I said. What was, she said. How you hold yourself. So proud I was afraid of you. You should be afraid of me, she said. I don't want to be afraid of you. Then you don't know what love is. She gathered a bowl of warm water, a straight-edge razor. Love should scare the hell out of you, she said, lathering me, her sweet smell all around. She shaved me, humming against my ear. Does that feel good, she said, but I couldn't talk. She flicked the edge of the blade against my cheek, bringing up blood. Don't move, she said. She took a pinch of salt from a bowl on the table, patting it against my face, licking it into the wound. And when she kissed my mouth, all that salt and blood and breath mixed between us. I'd never kissed a woman before and couldn't stop. Now you do me, she said, handing me the razor, but don't take too much. I took a dip from her beard, then cut and salted her, licked her salty wound and kissed her. And I kept kissing her. When I woke in the morning, she was warm against me. I'd never known I could fit someone like that. All my trouble was behind, it seemed. We couldn't imagine the ways we'd hurt each other down the road, all our suffering a million miles from the mystery we were grabbing after now. You're not really a freak, she said a few nights later as we lounged on our trailer bed, but I like you anyway. I am a freak, I said. Our faces were cross-hatched, pink and purple and red. You can say you are, she said. And you can say you are, I said. She handed me the razor. I lathered her and shaved a wisp of her beard away. Don't take too much, she said. I looked at her beautiful face, her beautiful beard, her translucence. I loved the way she talked and listened, the way she looked at me, her smell. I loved everything about her. I'm taking it all, I said. She looked at me. We looked at each other. You can grow another one, I said. She closed her eyes and sat straight on the edge of the bed, tilting her head so I could make a clean job of it. I took my time, careful not to cut her, while she hummed against me the most beautiful song I'd ever heard. Okay, that's the first one, Wonderland. Thanks. Thank you. This next one is one of the artifacts. So this is a fake book blurb. Rob, do you have your fake book blurb and good people?
No.
Okay. So this is a fake blurb. You know what a blurb is, the thing on the back of the book that says, I'm famous and you should buy this book. It says something like lush, riveting, a triumph. This is one of those, but this is an unsolicited blurb. So no one asked for this blurb. It's called Professor Astor's Unsolicited Blurb. Sometimes, very rarely, perhaps once a century or millennium, a book comes along that changes the very grind of the earth upon its axis, teaching us new ways to live. And when such a cataclysmic literary event occurs, and make no mistake, Tamara Swain's Piss Angels is such an event. We can only get out of the way as this juggernaut sweeps all of humanity breathlessly along in its wake, reshaping the very genetic coding and cellular structure of all beings, plant and animal, living and dead, leaving us enchanted and discarded, brutalized and tenderized, and certainly hours, if not days, older and grayer, and that much more exhausted and revitalized and hungry and horny and gaseous and sad and inert and alive. Because Piss Angels does not merely imitate life. Piss Angels is life. Tamara Swain herself is life, not just the most important writer of the last 50 generations, but also a beautiful, vital woman who happened to be my student and happened to fall in love with me, even as she begged me not to leave my wife and adolescent children for her, begged me not to introduce her to my agent, taught me over and over, first in my office, then in her apartment, also in the woods behind Barrett Hall and in so many other places, at AWP in the New York Hilton, for example, that our 35-year age difference meant nothing as we explored the terrain of each other's bodies and souls, that our 35-year age difference would mean even less in the future spread before us, and which we would inhabit eternally. Said age difference meaning less than nothing now, yes, but diminishing more when, for example, I would be 132 years old and Tamara only 97. I poured all of myself into Tamara as an artist, my student first, then my peer, and now with the arrival of Piss Angel, certainly my teacher, but also my friend, my lover, my grandmother, my pet, my Piss Angel. And your Piss Angel, if you'll just surrender to this remarkable novel, this collection of stories or poems or essays or whatever it is that Piss Angels really is, certainly not one thing, the Bible, for example, but everything, Shakespeare and gardening tools, ancient petroglyphs and crowns of sonnets and old women's toenail clippings and Virginia Woolf meets Alice Munro in a three-way with Grisham as observed by Oscar Wilde, and also nesting dolls and global warming and the Garden of Eden and the very sack of gold Jerry Lewis beat a crippled child to death with in the south of France in the presence of Jack and Jackie and their entire entourage, including two Secret Service agents sharing mutual longing for everyone and Jackie's lion handlers and the whole rest of the world sleeping and unaware that everything would change once Jack was killed 15 months later. Also cabbage and horses and the orgasms not had, the elusive orgasms finally achieved, but more often the orgasms not had, said not had orgasms shaping so much of our outer atmosphere. Not that Tamara and I had problems sexually, not really. Not that she didn't come time and again, the age difference bothering me more than her until she helped me let that go, because she's an old soul. At turns brutal and tender, gut-rippingly funny and eye-bleedingly sad, excruciatingly boring, rivetingly consuming, Piss Angels is a cerebral hemorrhage of a romp through one woman's uneventful journey through memory and the state of New Mexico and awakening desire and all kinds of harsh, unforgiving landscapes populated by somewhat distant, disconnected people who must somehow reflect elements of those harsh, unforgiving landscapes. There are horses in the book. There are fathers and mothers and sisters and cousins and neighbors and clerks and one adorable retarded scamp named Jimmy. There's a wise old cowboy, boiled and leathery, but in a sexually invigorating way, who reminds me of myself. And there's Tamara Swain's breathtaking prose, wrapped around a story so urgent, so fresh and commonplace, so necessary, that even my ex and estranged children will likely be healed and made whole by it, transformed into the people we all want to be, large enough to forgive, to find joy in other people's joy. Piss Angels will either kill us all or grant us everlasting life. It's that big, that important, that breathtakingly beautiful. Thank you, Tamara Swain, for changing and saving everything, for making everything brand new in a comfortable, familiar way. Please, come home now. New York is such a hateful place, and I can only imagine how lonely you must be there without me. Lucas Astor, PhD. Thanks. That one was really fun to write. And Rob and I were both in that. It was an anthology of fake blurbs. Rob, what was yours called? Poems for the Illiterate. Poems for the Illiterate was Rob's book. Read one more. So this one comes from a nursery rhyme. And the nursery rhyme is Sing a Song of Sixpence, which is the one that begins, Sing a Song of Sixpence, pocket full of rye, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie, goes on and on and on. So some of the lines from that children's rhyme I'm going to use. Sing a Song of Sixpence. The maid's nose was snipped off by a blackbird while she was hanging clothes in the garden. I didn't see it, having just walked away from the window upstairs, but there were plenty of witnesses, and while one claimed her nose was pecked off, and another claimed it was snapped off, and the maid herself, before bleeding to death, said it had definitely been snipped off, the essence of the thing remained the same. My beautiful Tammy was attacked by a blackbird while hanging laundry in the garden. This was after the pie was opened, after the king had turned to the bottle and the queen to one of her young lovers. It was a pattern with them, part of the reason for all the laundry. The king soiling his robes and pantaloons, the queen binging and purging and fornicating all over the castle. They were horrible people, the king and queen. What do you expect? Treat people like gods and they'll behave like swine. But I'm talking about Tammy here, my one true love, disfigured and wailing out in the garden. Had the physicians been able to stop her bleeding, I'd have gone on loving Tammy, with or without a nose. Without eyes, I'd have loved her. Without ears or a chin, ankles or elbows, propped on a straw bed for 93 years, I'd have worshipped Tammy. Had an eagle swooped down and pecked off Tammy's buttocks, severing her legs and causing them to fall from her body, I'd have braved fire, eaten rocks, tamed demons for the love of Tammy's torso. Had she but lived. The king was in the counting house, counting out his money. Do you see what I'm saying about these people? The king had a separate house for his money, brick and stone, while the rest of us lived in mud-daubed hovels. He kept a flask in his robe filled with rye, and I'd hear him grunting and muttering drunkenly in the counting house as he slobbered over his gold. The queen was in the parlor eating bread and honey. She could never get enough, and after she ate, she purged, and after she purged, she'd slather one of her boys with lard or butter, or wrap him in a string of sausages for more binging. Sometimes she'd nip at a finger or toe, but she hadn't started eating her lovers yet, not in earnest. The way she examined their haunches, though, poking and prodding, you knew it was only a matter of time. This is what I mean about these people, why someone had to stop them. It took 2 years to train the birds. Tammy thought we should use poison, but I wanted drama, the bold statement. Jackdaws, then, she said, or ravens, the ghosts of the murdered dead to peck out their fucking eyes. But it was blackbirds I wanted, the sweetness of their song. I did what I did for love, for Tammy. I did what I did for hatred. I did what I did as the one grand gesture of my life. Poetry must have something in it barbaric, vast, and wild, Tammy would say to me, quoting Diderot. We'd lay in our bed of dung, happy in spite of our loathing for our lords and ladies, and I'd quote Diderot right back to her. Hang the last king by the guts of the last priest, and we'd make wild pagan love until morning. Say what you will about bile and simmering rage. Our hatred for our betters bound us as much as anything. I love Tammy for the murder in her heart as much as for her club foot or cleft palate. We were the ones who should have been royal, or so much more than royal. Not a baker and scullery maid, but gods, wrathful and glorious, emerging from the sun, dripping fire. When the pie was opened, the birds began to sing. One tentative whistle, and then another, and then a keening chorus as they came to life inside the vented crust. The flurry that followed was the most startling thing I've ever witnessed. All my dreams of murder come to life on explosive black wing. I thought of Diderot's words. Only great passions can elevate the soul to great things. I thought of Tammy in the garden waiting for night, our furious love and hatred, our plotting and scheming, training these birds, and now the magic of their rising on wafts of steam, a flurry of feather and bird songs and gasps from the royal fuck faces as the birds prepared to peck through their eyes and into their worm-infested brains. The glory of it all. But those fucking birds, do you know what happened? They flew straight up and out the windows. That's what happened. After all that shrieking and flapping, the air fairly crackled. How horribly wrong it had all gone. Instead of a new life for Tammy and me, I would be led to the block for beheading. or more likely I'd be disemboweled, then beheaded, and finally quartered while Tammy would go on without me, quoting Diderot to somebody else. The king hit his flask. "Nicely done," he said to me. "Jim, is it?" I looked up from the floor. "Bob," I said. "Bravo, Bob," the king said, toasting me with his flask and taking another long pull. "Wasn't that a dainty dish?" the queen said, reaching for the pie pan and stuffing her gob with fistfuls of bird shit and crumbling crust. "Come on, Elizabeth," the king said. "We're not supposed to eat that." "Of course we're supposed to eat it," the queen said. "I'm going to the counting house," the king said, but the queen ignored him. I walked to the window and saw my Tammy in the garden below. The queen filled her pie hole. Maybe we'd find another way to set ourselves free. Outside, the blackbirds wheeled against a perfect blue sky. One pulled away from the others and circled on extended wing, drifting slowly, silently, down, down, down. Thanks.
All right, Sam Ligon. So we'll take about 10 minutes. If you guys would like to look at either Robert's or Sam's books, they are over there with Olivia from the campus bookstore beside the door.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. And for our next reader, we have Laura Miner is introducing our next reader. So please welcome Laura to the stage.
Hey. Thank you very much. Yes, I can. I know how to do it. At some point, I had a career, and I knew how to do this. Wait, nobody. All right, do it. Do the thing. All right.
Now it's too low.
No, it's cool, man. It's good.
Hey.
I first met Robert Lopez in 2008-09. We were in the computer lounge of the St. Francis College. It was a really dismal place to adjunct, I believe. I used to sneak the union members in behind the monks, you know. It was my first adjuncting gig back in the teaching world. And so, yeah, it was boring. I wasn't happy. It was not that exciting. And I was sitting in the computer lounge, and there was this small partition between us, and he said, "Hey, you know, we should exchange emails, because, you know, you look cool," or something, you know. And we did. And then, like, you know, I was trying to work, and a few moments later, I get this email, and it was like, "Hey, what's up?" And it was Robert, and he was right next to me. And I was like, you know what, this guy, I want to party with this guy. This is fun. Robert likes cookies and bourbon. He doesn't like onions or too much ice or heat. You don't like onions. Or heat or humidity or crickets or nature. He plays tennis. And that makes him happy, which makes me happy. One of my favorite things to do in New York was to sing and play music with Robert on the weekends, because we didn't like to go out. Because people. Once, when we sang together at Barbez, I realized that my friend Robert was becoming the link between the music world I was leaving and the creative writing world I was about to rejoin. We were hustling from one teaching job to another, to the next, you know. Like we all west around, you know, we all teach and write and try and pluck our golden tickets from the ether or whatever. We were doing that. And then I was untethered from the poetry world, which is kind of frightening if you think about it. Some of you have had gaps between your degrees and between your accomplishments, but when no one would read my poems, Robert read my poems. And then ultimately he just kind of pushed me into the deep end. I have yet to introduce, I've introduced a close friend, but I've never introduced an old friend. And I was delighted to see that he was on the docket for this semester, because he means business, and I like that. He's bulldozed the world of fiction in the last 10 years in a way that I don't think nothing can describe. I've never seen anyone do anything like it. HTML Giant called his second novel one of the most important books of the decade. And I think he gets compared to Beckett more than anyone ever. Especially in the biz right now. I mean, like, I feel like I should just walk and go, Beckett out, and like just walk away or something, but more to say than that. I think when I was thinking about this, Bomb magazine said it best. I've always liked Bomb. When they said, nobody else does whatever the hell it is Lopez is doing better than he does. And then went on to characterize his new book of stories, Good People, as dark, bitter, bitter comedy. That made me want to work at Baum. But I think it was actually Sam Lipsyte who won my heart when he characterized Robert's work as a bleak, joyful wit. I think people like reviewing Lopez's books because, like him, they're fun. They're original and they're fearlessly broken. Actually, if you Google him, fearless comes up so many times. For example, the LA Times characterized the narrators in Good People as misunderstood miscreants, comic horror, and amiable psychosis, which just warms my heart. Robert Lopez is the author of two novels, Part of the World and Can Be Belongo, Mean River, and two short story collections, Asunder and Good People. And he's already had, he already has a new novel, All Back Full, you have to remember that, All Back Full, coming out on Zank Books in February of this year, 2017. That makes 5 and 10 years, right? He also teaches at Pratt, where we taught together, and the New School in Columbia, and among other gigs, like I said, I mean, he means business. I wrote a song for Robert once. It was called Geronimo. And I thought it was really cool at the time because we were talking about Geronimo Rex by Barry Hanna. Yes, yes, woo. And it's the only song I've written for someone who it was for and about, but I had to cut it from the record, Robert, because it wasn't good enough. But it's all right because Robert understands quality control. We're very lucky to have him tonight. So before I hand the stage over, I mean, Robert is and was, he's brave enough to, you know, do the humidity here. Like, he doesn't like humidity, really doesn't. So I think we owe it to him to buy a book and to have it signed. And he has some books in the back, so please take a moment and buy that book and have him sign it, because I'm not sure you'll get another chance, because he really does hate humidity.
Laura, I don't like humidity either.
Okay. Well, none of us really do. Although it is, it keeps our skin supple. He's funny. He's really funny. And he's wild and he's cool. And he works hard and he plays even harder. So you have to kind of say that kind of stuff about a fiction writer because they're all built on rep, you know, for the big bucks eventually. So on behalf of the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writer Series, please join me in welcoming Robert Lopez to the stage.
No, we're fine. We're good. I think so. Thank you, Laura, for that great introduction. That was very nice indeed. The weather is awful here, but you know that already. You don't need me to tell you that. I thought there was a hurricane happening this afternoon. I mean, that was insane. Okay, but, you know, we survived it. I'm going to read a couple little things here from Good People. And it's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you for having us. This one's called Anytime Sweet. This moves. Okay. The waitress delivered the food and drinks in a single carry. I was like everyone else in the diner. We were a congregation of unhealthy people with no alternatives and no resources. I've been coming here every day for weeks. Earlier, I had walked through a hard hat area without a hard hat. The sign said I should beware, but I never pay attention to signs. I'm never wary of anything. Lately, I've had heartburn every night and wake up with a headache every morning. I told the waitress thank you. I told her she was impressive. She looked me in the face and smiled. I felt genuine warmth coming from her. I could tell she was a good person. She said, "You are very welcome." I wanted to give her another compliment, so I said, "You have nice tits." She smiled again, said, "You are a sweet one." It was true. I've always been sweet. People tell me this. The headache always starts at the top and then works its way down in every direction. I almost fell to the ground when I walked through the hard hat area, but I steadied myself on a bicycle rack. I'm sure no one saw me as this happened. Certainly someone would have tried to help. She asked if I would like to touch them. And I said, "Of course." I touched them for a solid minute. All around the restaurant, people were eating and drinking and discussing current events, the people in their lives, how it was going all wrong. No one saw what we were doing, and I'm sure no one would have minded. No one would have tried to help. She asked me what I thought, and I said they were wonderful. It was true, no one could disagree, they were wonderful. This is what I wondered as I touched the waitress's tits. I wondered if she had a happy childhood. I wondered if she participated in after-school activities like bowling or Girl Scouts. I wondered if the mouse running roughshod in my apartment would realize his mistake soon. I wondered if my ex-wife was feeding the dog. I wondered how much longer I could live on bacon and eggs, home fries, and coffee. Finally, I wondered if it would be like they said, like a piano on the chest. This is when I took my hands off her tits, picked up my fork, and dug in. I told her, "Thank you again," and she said, "Anytime, sweet." I smiled for her real wide. I went back to the eggs and the rest of my life. Thank you. This is another short little bit. This one's called Someone Great Like Socrates. There's more than one reason I tied you to that bedpost. If you recall, it had been raining. That's first and foremost. Also, the bathroom and how you were always in there cleaning it. I cannot count how many times I found you hunched over the tub, your hair up in that bandana, listening to the stereo loud and scrubbing away to the rhythm of the music. I can't tell you the toll this took on me. There's so much I can't tell you. I needn't remind you that neither of us was in good health nor spirits at the time. I think I was sleeping 16 hours a day and you were up to a quart of gin. All of this taken together could devastate anyone, I think. I, like you, am human. Like you, I know nothing. The rest we can sort out later. If there is no later, please allow me to say this. Be careful who you look at on the subway. They might want money or to kill you. You have to question the mentality of anyone who willingly looks at another on the subway. Someone great like Socrates would say the same thing had he lived in the city. If you get yourself killed, I would count it as an unspeakable tragedy, even if I don't know you anymore, even if by then you're already dead to me. Socrates himself was put to death on a subway, I'm almost certain. He made the mistake of looking up when someone asked for everyone's attention and they made him drink hemlock for his troubles. This isn't the kind of information you can get just anywhere. You know what you're giving up. Do you remember the time I tied you to that bedpost and we discussed Socratic paradoxes and the peculiar ways of the world? I believe I was accused of something horrific and I needed you to sit still long enough to explain myself. I believe I made myself clear while I was applying the ointment. The gist was, have you ever boarded a train and gone someplace because why the fuck not? Maybe to see what a new life might be like on the windy side of an old one. Maybe to get away from the panhandlers on the subway, to say nothing of the philosophers and murderers. To say nothing of bedposts and slipknots. If you do this, remember me to any perfect stranger once you arrive and tell them what I've always told you, that I know nothing. Tell them, in spite of this, I said, take special care. Always, please, take very special care. This last one is a little bit longer, but I'm not going to read the whole thing because nobody deserves that sort of thing. This is called A Regular Day for Real People. I told my friend I was about to sleep with his sister. I told him to sit tight. Outside, the world was in motion, and I watched it from a fourth-story window. From there, I could see almost everything. From there, I could see the earth and the structures built upon it. I could see people and animals and how everyone conducted themselves in broad daylight. From there, I could hasten my demise should I finally choose to do so. My friend and his sister wouldn't want that, though, to say nothing of the world at large. I keep this in mind because all of us are on the verge of something, a new way of life, maybe. I had been there for most of the last year, at the window, watching the world in motion, considering this new way of life, considering the nuances of defenestration. I developed a keen appreciation for weather. Sometimes it rained. When it rained from top to bottom and from side to side. If you squinted and tilted your head, the opposite was true. The wind played a part in this, certainly, if there was a wind. Otherwise, there were days that were cloudy and uncloudy. I sat on the precipice, poised. I had recently spoken with my friend. I called early in the morning and woke him. I told him I was about to sleep with his sister. I told him to sit tight. He said, "What? Who?" I said, "I have no time for games," and hung up on him. Afterward, I went straight back to the window and looked out of it. I could see many buildings and even more windows into those buildings. In other words, I was at one window, mine own, looking into others I know not of. Should I consider this too closely, I'd lose my way and drag everyone down with me. Such is the nature of windows. My friend worked a job, commingled with others, participated in society. I don't know how he, or anyone for that matter, can do such things. I'd known him since childhood. He was a fine boy, spoke in complete sentences, had perfect table manners. I never thought either of us would live long enough that we'd work jobs and participate in society. I remember a conversation we had once while playing tennis. I was 10 times better than him, but he liked playing anyway. Secretly, he resented me for being 10 times better than him, but I tried not to hold it against him. I think I told him during a changeover that I couldn't see either of us reaching middle age. He said, "You're probably right," said we'd be lucky to see a third set. There was no reason for this fatalism if this was, in fact, fatalism. It was more than anything else a lack of imagination. I think this is why I try to look into windows. I can't imagine what might be going on in there. I don't remember much of his sister, as I think they kept her hidden from the likes of me. The people outside the window were unscrupulous. There was no sense of right and wrong, and this was indicated in how they moved about the world in motion, as if they were balanced, as if they had a clear idea and a destination in mind. Otherwise, the people outside were inscrutable. I'm not sure I know the difference between unscrupulous and inscrutable. Some of these had dogs. They led the dogs around on leashes, if you can picture that. My friend's sister was in the bedroom waiting for me. I'm not sure if she had a dog. I haven't seen her with a dog, but she is the type to have one. I have trouble keeping time, which is why I don't know when all of this happened. From the window, you can't tell time, and there are no clocks within eyeshot, and I'm not clever enough to make my own calendar. I don't know how long I've been here at my window, but at some point, I began playing tennis under the everywhere sky. Surely I've done other things since coming to my window, but I can't remember what. But other than my window, what I specifically remember is being out there on the tennis court. There were other people playing at the same time, but they were none of mine. They were inscrutable or unscrupulous. I was out on the court with my friend's sister, the one whose brother I had hung up on earlier, the one I was about to sleep with, whose backhand slice was devastating, whose first serve was unimaginable. Anyone watching was thusly dazzled. I am a sight to see out there on the court, a man of my size, moving like that, covering the entire playing surface, sideline to sideline, net to baseline. I've always been tremendous, standing up at 6'8" and weighing down at 280 pounds. Should I finally throw myself out the window, imagine the sight of it, let alone the sound. The stakes were agreed upon beforehand. Should she win, I was to leave her alone forever, never to darken her doorstep, write, call, or otherwise contact her while everyone was still alive and upright. Should I win, she'd have to sleep with me. I think I had a strange look on my face when I first proposed this, because she had a strange look on her face after I said it. Still, she agreed. She probably had no choice, as I was threatening the life of her brother at the time. I told her I had him confined at an undisclosed location. At first, she didn't believe me. She thought I was bluffing. "I have your brother," I said. She said, "What do you mean you have him?" "I have your brother," I said. "That's exactly what I mean." "Where do you have him?" "I have him confined at an undisclosed location." "I don't believe you," she said. "You're bluffing," she said. This is when I showed her a Polaroid of her brother tied up and gagged at the undisclosed location. I propped up a copy of that day's newspaper on his chest to prove this was actually happening, and I meant business. I saw someone do this in a movie once. In the movie, they didn't leave a telephone for the hostage to answer. This is how what I've done is better than the movie. I'm not exactly sure how it's better, but I know that it is. I told my friend not to get any big ideas about calling the cops. I told him if he called the cops, I'd have to do unspeakable things to his sister. This is how they talk in the movies, so I figured I should do likewise. He knew I meant business. Still, he said I should reconsider. I told him I thought this all the way through, that I knew what I was doing. The sister said again, I can't believe this. I said, what can't you believe? She said, this, what it is you're doing. I said, it's a regular day for real people, nothing more. The sister said, I don't know what that means. I said, no one does. I told her it was something to do, a reason to live. I told her everyone needed a new way of life, and this was the beginning of it. I talked about purpose, something to look forward to, goals and dreams. I talked about what I'd seen from my window, how I couldn't imagine any of it. I talked about defenestration, said it might not be the right answer, but it was indeed an answer. She said, but I don't understand the question. I told her, you and me both. I knew the sister was a great tennis player, which was part of the thrill, to play someone on that level, to challenge myself like this with something at stake. I'd seen her play years before. I think this is when my plans started to come together, watching her toy with those overmatched teenage opponents. The skirts she wore back then, that ponytail bouncing behind her, as playful as a little dog. Part of the deal was I'd release her brother either way after the match, regardless of the outcome. Still, she might have felt a certain pressure to throw the match if she cared at all about her brother. I didn't discourage this. I may have even said, I hope this works out for your brother's sake. To make it more cinematic, I had to tune up her brother a little. It's more effective if the Polaroid indicates the hostage has been beaten. I took no pleasure in beating my friend like that. I told him this. I told him, I take no pleasure in having to beat you like this. I told him I had no choice. He took the beating like a man. I'll say that much for him. The match started early in the morning, before the sun could get vindictive, before the rain could go sideways and the wind too. The weather promised to be an issue all day. They were calling for temperatures in the mid-90s come early afternoon with the possibility of thunderstorms. We warmed up together as tennis players do, starting with Minnie for a few minutes, then to the baseline for ground strokes. Then she came to the net for volleys and overheads, then I did. Then we served into both courts, both deuce and ad. I could tell she was focused. There was a buzz as the crowd gathered. Apparently word had gotten out. I was a legend by the time I turned 14, so it's no surprise. By then, I was already the biggest and strongest in our neighborhood and can serve upward of 140 miles an hour. That's funny. I was on the lookout for a film crew, as I'd heard that a famous documentarian had gotten wind of this. But that was years ago, I think. I hadn't played since the injury, since my friend low-bridged me during a friendly game of touch football. I did think of this as I tuned him up earlier. I may have even said this out loud. As I broke his jaw, I may have said, remember the friendly game of touch football in the park? He said he was sorry, but I didn't believe him. He said it was part of the game, that he didn't mean it, that it wasn't illegal. I spun the racket and said up or down. My friend's sister waited a split second and said up, and when the racket fell to the court, the logo was indeed pointing up. I prepared to return her serve and situated myself a solid foot behind the baseline, with my legs straddling the sideline. I knew she tended to go out wide on the deuce court, so I started to lean that way as she tossed the ball high in the air. Her toss was elegant, like the way a ballerina would serve. Graceful arm extended skyward, ball rolling off long fingers as though she was inviting it into the air not 2 feet above her head. She blasted one down the tee, which I managed to get a racket on. The ball floated deep into her court for me to have a chance in this first point, but her next shot pinned me in the backhand corner, and she fouled behind it for an easy put away. She won the first game at love and had a smirk on her face as we changed ends. I responded in kind and held serve, and then she held serve, and this went on for 8 games until I broke for a 5-4 lead. For some reason, I tightened up at this point, double faulted twice during my service game and was broken right back. She took the tiebreaker. We were playing a best of 5 sets, so I wasn't worried. I figure I'd let her win the first set to get her hopes up, get her overconfident. And it goes on from there. Thank you very much.
Let's hear it for Robert Lopez. One more round of applause, please. And we'd ask you to kindly bus your bottles and glasses back to the bar for us and join us next week for poets Mari Carter and Alex Quinlan. Thanks again.